Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the all-new Opel Crossland. Beauty isn't scared of life.
I'm joined now by the World Health Organization's Special Envoy on COVID-19, Dr. David Nabarro. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Claire. Lovely to be with you again.
Thank you very much for joining us. And now, the first thing we want to talk about is this single case of the new B1525 variant. This is a new thing that we welcomed to our shores, I'm sure reluctantly. Last night it was confirmed that it has been found here. What do you know about this variant?
I'm afraid I can't give you a lot of detail about it, but I want to say just one basic point. Viruses are constantly changing. They don't stay the same. They're always what we call mutating. And then occasionally mutants survive and become what we call variants of concern. There are various variants emerging around the world. Almost all of them, when they are able to survive, have some advantage over the original form of the virus. They either transmit more easily or they're capable of actually causing slightly more disease even in the body. So let's just recognize that this is going to happen constantly, and thank you to the Irish authorities for doing the necessary analysis to find that B1525 has actually hit Ireland. I'm not going to actually anticipate what this might mean, but there's just one thing to say, that the way we stop all these variant viruses from spreading is just the same way as we work with the original virus. It's through the proper practices of physical distancing, mask wearing, self-isolation when sick, and maintaining really good hygiene. We have to keep that practice up. We, the people, are the solution. Whatever variant appears, and we've got to maintain the discipline to do it.
But when people here see these things coming in, they just, I mean, you look at Ireland, it's an island. You know, we could just stop them arriving on our shores.
Well, that's the two parts to it. One is you try to stop variants from coming in, but you can't close the country forever. Ireland's success in the world depends on being able to receive people coming in and also being able to travel out. So it's partly work at the borders, but it's also having the capacity in the country at the county level to pick up the emergence of variants. And when cases build up in a spike, then what you have to do is to be able to suppress that spike fast. And that is through really good quality detection and then isolation, then contact tracing, isolating the contacts. What you've been doing so well in the past, keep it going. Whether it's a variant or the original virus, that's the technique you use. And work at the borders, of course, necessary too.
You've explained how the variants crop up really well. I was reading about this Californian variant that they seem to be concerned about in New York now. But do we have any concrete information as of now about whether these new variants are more resistant to the vaccines that are available?
Do you know, that's a difficult one. You can take the blood from somebody who's been vaccinated and you can mix that blood with the virus and see whether or not the blood contains antibodies that can neutralize the virus. And that's the quick and common technique for checking whether or not a vaccinated person is able to deal with a variant. But there's more to immunity than the antibodies that appear in the blood. There's a whole second part of immunity. It's called cell-mediated immunity, where cells in the body are primed to be able to run and then kill a virus when it comes in. You don't test for that cell-mediated immunity through the normal testing of the neutralizing capacity of someone's blood. And we just don't know yet for certain to what extent people who are immunized with the vaccines that are currently being used, what their capacity is to deal with the variants. We only find that out when we see how the variants spread through the population and whether immunized people are actually made ill by the variants. Only time will tell.
Okay, well, everyone's looking, speaking of time, towards the summer, David, and Greece has indicated that it has a deal done with Israel, a bilateral travel agreement, and apparently it's in talks with the UK to do the same. So can you imagine all of the UK going on holidays to Greece? What do you think when you hear about these chats, talks, deals happening on travel?
Well, we've discussed this before, even when there was talks about air bridges between Ireland and other countries last year. I think for the time being, it will be bilateral discussions between countries that indicate whether travel corridors can be opened up. And I'm not going to say that there's anything wrong with that. I suppose as a person working with the World Health Organization, my hope is that we'll be able to get protocols that apply to more than just two countries, but they'll apply to the whole of Europe. And I think the European Union is going to be a very important venue for working that out. So just wait a little bit before making all your holiday plans, people. I think that in a few weeks, there'll be much more clarity on what the arrangements for travel during the summer months are going to be. It'll depend a lot on what's going on with the virus, but it'll also depend a lot on how well countries are able to coordinate their protocols for travel.
I think you're suggesting that we might have travel within the European Union for this summer.
I'm hopeful that there will be more opportunities for travel within the European Union this summer that will go beyond just bilateral arrangements between countries. I just can't say for certain it will happen because there are quite a lot of variables that people will want to think about. For example, are there new variants emerging and where are they emerging? And also, how well are countries organised with their testing, tracing and isolating systems? It's work to come. But I'm very nervous about saying things about the future. But I'm hopeful, Claire, that there will be more opportunities for travel in the coming months than what we see right now. Okay, I'm hoping for it for myself. You know, I want to see I've got a grandchild I haven't even met yet in the UK, and I'm living in France. So like, I'm just got my fingers crossed, like everybody else, really.
So you're hopeful that you might be able to make that journey safely this summer?
I hope so, yes. And I haven't been vaccinated yet, and I'm hopeful that I'll be able to make that journey without needing to show that I've got some certificate saying that I've been vaccinated. It should be possible, but who knows? I just can't put my money on it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that next, because we know that the EU leaders were talking about vaccine certification, and there was a suggestion that that could happen within 3 months, which wouldn't be soon enough for some people, although others
not
are completely against the idea. I mean, what's your sense of it?
Well, when I was travelling around 10 years ago, I was always taking a little yellow thing next to my passport. It's my yellow fever vaccine certificate, because there are many countries in the world that I just couldn't travel to without an up-to-date yellow fever vaccine. And that's not something that's new. It's something that we've had for a long time. In your vaccine certificate, there's one very important piece of information. What vaccine were you given? And what was the batch number? And that's because in case there are any problems with the vaccine, you need to know the batch number as well as the vaccine itself, just so that people can say, you might be at risk because of the batch that you had. So I'm really in favour of anybody who receives a vaccine, particularly the new vaccines for COVID, because we just don't know what interaction might happen between variants and whether or not, and particular vaccines that people have received. So yes, I want certificates. I'd like them to say when the vaccine was given, how many doses were given, what vaccine it was, what the batch number was, where the manufacturer was. All that stuff should be on the certificate. It just is an extra assurance that you know what you've been given, just in case you bump up against a particular variant.
And that could happen sooner than 3 months, as the EU leader said last night.
It should happen, but there's a second part to this, that everybody who's given a vaccine should know what vaccine they've been given. That's I think, without question. The big difficult issue is then, should that certificate serve as a passport for whether or not you can get on a plane to go from Dublin Airport to Athens Airport? Well, I'm not quite personally ready to say that we're at that point, simply because there's just not enough vaccine around. There's not enough people to be vaccinated, really, to be planning travel in the coming months on the basis of what one might call a vaccine passport. I just don't think we're at that point yet. But yes, the discussion should be happening, because there will be a point in, hopefully in 2021, when an awful lot more people are vaccinated, and the prospect of vaccination status being something that's taken into account whether you can travel from A to B. I think that will come. But I don't think it'll come in 3 months, Claire.
There's lots of that Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine around the EU, according to the ECDC numbers, and it's not yet been used because it would appear from what we're hearing back from reports from the different countries that people are saying, no, I don't want that one. I'd rather have the Pfizer or the Moderna.
I heard that. I saw that in press reports. Because of where I work and my approach on this, I think I want corroboration.
Let me give you the ECDC figures, right? So they say that there are 4.9 million doses of the Oxford vaccine which have not been administered. This is out of the 6.1 million doses that have been distributed among the 27 member states.
Yeah. And then my question is, what's the reason for non-administration? Using a vaccine and giving it to sections of the population, so you start with people, say, over 85, you then go to people over 75, you then go to people over 65, and you then go to the next younger age group, or some system like that. Operating in that way is not easy, especially with vaccines that have to be looked after very carefully. And so I'm not ready to respond to your question with a suggestion that people are actually on a significant way refusing one particular vaccine. Mm-hmm. I'd also want to check, is this perhaps a result also of logistical challenges of doing this this segmentation of the population by age? And let's just wait and see a little bit longer before we start to say there really is a preference for one vaccine over the other. Personally, I would take whichever vaccine I'm offered, because the vaccines that have been approved are approved for their efficacy and their safety. And right now, the World Health Organization has approved both the biotech Pfizer vaccine, as well as the AstraZeneca vaccine produced from the Serum Institute of India, the AstraZeneca vaccine produced from South Korea. They've all been given the necessary approval. And I personally, as I say, think that they're all pretty good vaccines.
Because Angela Merkel was asked about this last night. She hasn't been vaccinated because the only vaccine available to her was AstraZeneca. She's 66 and they're not giving it to people over 65 in Germany. But she admitted when she was asked that there's an acceptance problem among Europeans being offered Oxford AstraZeneca. So she would appear to confirm that there's an issue there with how people feel about Oxford AstraZeneca. I wonder, would you say it's time now to look again at the data around the efficacy in the over 60 for that particular one?
Well, I was just going to tell you that the WHO's scientific committee that looks at vaccine efficacy produced a recommendation saying, as far as they were concerned, this Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is effective and safe for use in people of all ages. It did not come out with an age cutoff for efficacy. Now, that's a scientific committee, and that's how we work in the WHO. And the recommendations of that scientific committee then had a huge influence on whether or not WHO gave that vaccine the emergency use license. So I have huge respect for political leaders when they give an opinion on these kinds of things. But what I work on is what the technical groups of the WHO have come out with. And again, as far as I'm concerned, it's okay to receive the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. It's okay to receive the other vaccines that have been approved. And I leave my own position at that.
Now, there's an opinion poll here in the Irish Times this morning, David, and it shows that 68% of people want to get back to normal once the elderly and vulnerable have been vaccinated. Is that a dangerous place for us to be?
It depends what you define as normal. As far as I'm concerned, normal, as the vaccines are being rolled out, is still being in a situation of being respectful of this virus. It doesn't mean that everything has to stop, but it does mean that we have to maintain the precautions that reduce our risk of being infected by the virus, even if we've been vaccinated, just in case the virus can still come into our bodies. It doesn't make us sick, but we might still transmit it. So then it'll be a new normal, a normal that's respectful of the virus, but it should not mean that we stop activity again, that we have to go back into lockdown. All will depend on what the overall situation of virus levels in the population are. But my request to everybody is don't give up on what we've all learned to do over the last year, which is to treat this virus with respect and prevent it from spreading through the way in which we behave.
Yeah, but we could be entering into a dangerous period. You know, if we feel our elderly people are being vaccinated, our vulnerable people are being vaccinated, well, look, you know, I'm just going to go about my business now because I feel that those people I was most worried about are protected.
Mm. Yeah, but that's where people like me have to go on being the people who pour cold water on hopes and expectations. I'm not saying that life has to going to be stopped. And you know, because I've told you and we've discussed before, that really we would much rather that people continue to practice the personal protection that we require. And we avoid going back into lockdown. But in all infection control efforts, the time when societies are most at risk are when the numbers are dropping, especially if they're dropping fast. And it's when you get towards the bottom of what we call the epidemic curve, when the numbers are really low, that if people let up their guard, then you can get a bounce back and we're in a difficult situation again. So you're so right, Claire. It's a difficult and potentially dangerous time coming up right now.
David, good to talk to you as always. Dr. David Nabarro there from the World Health Organization. Coming up on the programme, sometimes you just need a good cry. And next we'll have the best tearjerker TV to let it all out.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.